there's a familial connection, people they meet in the emergency room.
Right.
So we would put you on the
site. Quite a few of them have dated police officers from the 6061.
What could be done in a hospital situation to try and cut back on this kind of, because this allows, for example, stories to be set up about what happened to people, the possibility that someone, if they have a conflict of interest, that they might help concoct a story to take a policeman off the, to get him off. If, in fact, someone was brought in like Abner Muima. What could be done? Do you have any ideas?
I think there should be a state law into this to make sure that these cases are reported when they come to the hospital.
Requiring them to report these cases.
Right, right.
Right now they're not required to report.
They're not required to report anything, but I think this should put into law.
Thank you very much. Do you have any plans what you're going to do next?
Well, I'm going to be transferred to another city hospital. I just hope to work peacefully there.
Is this at your request?
Yes, that's my request, to leave there.
How about your job? Do you fear for your job that you might have, like, promotion possibilities, might be interfered with or in some way discriminated against because of this?
Not if I'm transferred.
How long have you been a nurse?
I am a nurse for 1 year.
For 1 year?
I've been working at Coney Island for 7 years as a nurse's aide.
Oh, wow. Where did you go to school?
College of Staten Island.
So you're aware of the situation at Coney Island?
Yeah.
Do you think it's particularly worse there? I've heard stories that it's a little worse there than other emergency rooms.
I'm not sure of that. I have not been to other emergency rooms. But I know we have had a lot of cases where the patients came in and said, you know, the police did this to me.
I wanted to ask you if the privatization or the attempted privatization of Coney Island Hospital, how that's affected what's going on there, and if at all.
I really don't know what's the latest to that is. I mean,
interesting connection to make. Yeah. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Documenting what they say is a pattern of police abuse in Asian American communities.
If my son was shot in the back, then the officer should be arrested. And
this kind of ineffective and at times incompetent behavior by NYPD.
He shot my son in the back. He's always.
Someday the Times will stumble upon this tragedy.
Robinson, an African-American plainclothes transit officer, was shot several times in the back by a white off-duty officer, Peter Del Debbio.
This is a call from an inmate at a correctional facility.
It's amazing to me how we can always afford another policeman to build another prison.
This cut that the mayor is instituting will destroy the ability to care for all the citizens of New York.
The WBAI Evening News, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m.
Magali Loren being awarded the Courageous Resistance Award by Refuse and Resist back in September of 1997. And it was interesting.
This whole saga began.
Yes, the Abner Louima story, which is playing out in Brooklyn Federal Courthouse as we speak.
How long do you think the jury will deliberate?
I don't know, 20 minutes? No. I think it's going to be a tough one. I
mean,
can't really say that. I was just joking.
It's basically counting on the ID, right? That there was no ID.
It's not going to be easy, yeah. It's not going to be easy to get a conviction of these four officers. I don't think so, because they don't have the positive ID. However, you have the fact that Justin Volpe admitted it. And you have this.
But the jury doesn't know that he said somebody was in the court in the bathroom with him.
But I can say that if you're there and listen to the actual testimony and what's said in court,
yeah,
it doesn't all. It's even hard for me to tell it all. So much is said, and it is so complicated. But it does tend to give you this gut feeling that these guys are all up to something. You know, nothing. There's just no way. There's no evidence, and because of reasonable doubt, they might get off. But nobody who listens to all that testimony cannot have a bad taste at the back of their mouth that this kind of behavior is fairly common. And you know, my experience is that
what must have been going on there.
Yeah,
this was,
if not
what it
the actual, if it wasn't like this, you know, Schwartz's. I mean, the lawyer referred to. One of the other officers' lawyer referred to Volpe as a monster.
That's right.
He used the term "he's a monster."
That
and
solidarity between the cops is dissipated.
He said he's a monster, and how could you compare my good, and this is tendency to try and make it seem like this one guy, Joseph Volpe, went bananas. And he is a monster. I mean, his own father in the New York Times admitted his son was a monster. I mean, the guy went bananas. He went crazy. I heard him testify. I heard testimony by Patrick Antoine that as he was being taken to the bathroom, Volpe told him, "I went a little crazy."
Right.
He asked him, he said, "Actually,
do
you think I'm acting crazy?" is actually how he put it. And, he asked if he believed in God. He asked Antoine if he believed in God as he took him into the bathroom. But Magalie Loren put it pretty clearly when she said, like, at the hospital, why wasn't it that there was...
Why did it take so long for someone to call in the
right,
authorities when it's obvious that this man had been sodomized with a foreign object?
If it was so difficult for nurses and emergency room technicians to come forward, you know that there was something going on in that precinct house. You know, you're not going to tell me that there was an unnamed other person in that bathroom and nobody knows who it is?
Yeah, everybody knows.
Somebody. Everybody knows everybody in the damn precinct. It's only, I don't know, it's not that many people working together.
Everybody knows who was in there.
Of course. And
well, they do have the tie.
You know how juries are.
Well, it's hard. I was going to say, do you want to try for a jury assessment this time? Because the last
they were
time
biting
I
their
asked,
lips. I saw blood about to come from. You know, they were biting their lips so hard, you were ready to see blood. Some
serious,
of them.
Serious.
I don't know if they were afraid or they were angry. There was a couple of people who looked very straight. A couple of young girls who seemed real straight. And they were like,
it's a heavy responsibility,
One was like staring ahead in like, I swear this person's head did not move 1 millimeter in 5 hours.
Frozen.
The other one next to her was moving around like in every, like withering. Couldn't hold still for a second. There was people who couldn't look in the eyes. You know, they just looked away. It seems like they're either, you know, you can't read people's minds, but a lot of disgust, a lot of real like, you don't know if they're angry or they're scared or they're just so disgusted by the whole thing and that they're getting a new view of the police that they never had before. And I'm not just talking about what happened in that bathroom or what happened on the street, but just the general everyday way that business is done. Right. The militarization of it, the back scratching, the offhanded comments, and why don't you speak English, damn niggas, this and that, all this kind of stuff, you know? This is what goes on all the time.
It's a regular course of conduct.
Yeah.
And it's not impressive. It's very disturbing.
It's mighty disturbing, you know, even for a progressive person who knows, you know. Both of us have seen how the system operates close up. And we know how it operates. And a lot of our listeners know how it operates. But it's one thing to know, and it's another thing to experience it and to see it laid out in detail.
To hear all the details.
Right. Really, you see all the details. And it gives you the feeling that, you know, what was going on in this precinct.
Well, I keep saying, how many people did they sodomize before Abner Lewin?
And whatever else they did. Our number is 212-209-2900. We're going to give you callers, listeners, a chance to call. Court last couple of days.
Yeah, Paul's been covering.
I've been there. I was there all day today. I listened to some of the
closing arguments
by the. Thank you. You can tell your lawyer.
Sorry.
No, thank you for helping me. The closing arguments. I heard the Alan Vingrad, the prosecutor, the United States Attorney.
Right.
He gave his. I got the last hour of it. You know, he talked for over 3 hours.
Wow.
And He said some pretty amazing things. Some of the stuff I read that was we read right here in this
three
AP
hours
award
is a long
AP report. Yeah, he went on for 3 hours. It got a little tiresome. It was very complicated because there's so much. The evidence
we've got
is
four
based,
different defendants,
right? And it's based on like radio reports following where they were, and everybody saying they were in different places, and. You know, Abner was either wrong about a place he was in or was beaten a different place than he was in those streets. I mean, he thought he was at this street, but he was really at that
over
street.
There, right.
And we're talking about a few blocks away, but this is the
stuff
of reasonable
doubt.
Well, let's
not forget he's being beaten during all of this.
Right, and they're trying to say he wasn't beaten. They're trying to say he was a liar because they're trying to use the fact that Magali Loren's brother-in-law admitted to having...
Suggested
that they use the word Giuliani time to get the attention of the media. They used the fact that there seemed to have been, at first, before they knew what had happened in the precinct, there was a, according to some of the defense attorneys, an attempt by Abner Luima, by some of Abner Luima's friends and family members to concoct their own story to make it look like Abner was attacked and beaten in front of the club, which they deny happened, and which was basically mentioned earlier on in the grand jury testimony, and then never brought up again in the actual prosecution. They just are focusing.
Are they less?
There was originally three beatings.
Right.
The first one in front of
the club.
The second one at Glenwood and Nostrand,
the car, right.
And the third one at Glenwood and Bedford.
Right.
And what? The first one was dropped because it seems that was sort of concocted before they knew what had happened to Abner inside
in the
jail,
bathroom,
in the bathroom of the jail. And they were basically, there was a near riot that happened on the streets there. I don't know what started it. Nobody really knows what started it, but there was 200 people in the street.
Right.
Dozens of cops showed up. They were there was an all-out battle in the street for control of the street. I don't know, and nobody seems to know what started it. Or why it developed and got so big, and what the role of these police officers in it was. No, it really hasn't come out very clearly what that was. But there was an attempt of self-defense in order to bring a story that would be helpful to Abner, that he was attacked, and in fact he was attacked.
Right.
You know?
I'm curious also whether
he was mistaken for someone else.
The defense attorneys have turned from. Trying to discredit Abner Luima since the confession by Volpe. Have they turned all their aggression against Volpe now?
Want
or
to hear,
are they still
want to hear the lawyers I have on tape. We have Stuart London, and
okay,
we have
we'll take some
Joseph
calls.
Tacopina, the lawyers who spoke today.
Okay.
Bruder's lawyer, Bruder's lawyer. Bruder was a Volpe partner. Weiss, who was allegedly one of the cops involved in one of the beatings on the way to the 7-0.
To the station. Right.
Right. And this is their defense. So let's listen to what they had to say. And it's just a few minutes. So then we'll be taking your call, 212-209-2900. Better let them answer these questions.
That they have no evidence and the arguments were twisted. The arguments that the prosecutor was making were not based on the evidence in the record, and that was the most important. The fact that my guy's a good guy is there in the record, but what was more important than that was that there was no ID, the wrong location, the wrong car. I mean, there was absolutely nothing there. Yet the prosecutor was arguing on and on about how there was, and I wanted to let them know there's a difference between argument and evidence.
Mr. London, how do you feel
you communicated with the jury? Do you feel that they were...
Very well, yeah, very well.
Mr. London, do you think it's a risk, though, as much as you sympathize with Luima's injuries in the bathroom, to keep calling him a liar over and over again regarding the patrol car?
Not at all. You have to sympathize with his injuries because he received injuries in the bathroom. That from Volpe's plea. By the same token, it doesn't give you a free pass to have innocent people indicted and ruin innocent people's lives. And I think that's our job, and I think the jury can appreciate that if your arguments are based on the evidence in the record, and I believe that our arguments were.
What about the guilt by association? You say, you know,
Guilt by association is real. I think anyone who was Justin Volpe's partner that night would have been indicted. It didn't make a difference. And that's what I was trying to tell the jury, that there's really nothing to identify my client as being involved in any assault of conduct other than guilt by association, which is outrageous.
And explain the radio transmission the government says puts your client at the location.
Right. The radio transmissions clearly put my client at Glenwood and Bedford. The interesting thing about that is the government is now arguing based on unsworn testimony. They're arguing that Louima is wrong about where it occurred. Why? Because they can't put my client at Glenwood and Nostrum. They can put him at Glenwood and Bedford. So let's change the witness's testimony without asking him.
At one point during the government summation, stay with me on those. Does that say anything to you about the complexity of the circumstantial evidence?
I think it says volumes. I think what he's... It's hard for me to comment on that, but I think if you have to say stay with me, it's not clear, it's not obvious. What he's doing is saying don't believe my witness, believe me. And that was my point about there's a difference between evidence and argument. You base a verdict on evidence, you don't base a verdict on argument. Thank you.
Minutes or so.
Okay.
Change diapers. Now it's over for me. I'm going to tell my wife it was adjourned for two more weeks. She's been great because of the submission.
So what about your client?
The
next couple of days, you what do you want the jury to think about your client?
Well,
you
yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, basically what I said in my summation is what I want them to think. When it comes to him, just the evidence as it relates to him, not the evidence as it relates to people who aren't here anymore. Who may have said things in the opening statement to taint the rest of us, but aren't here anymore. And, you know, that's sort of laid out for them, and hopefully they'll follow the rules that the judge gives them.
So how can you place this?
You're right. They said it was full of blood, and I said there were drops, and... You know, I think the evidence, again, local rules, and I think the evidence will speak for itself, and I hopefully the jury, and I think, you know, that they're following along, and if they're following along, I'm confident that they will see things the way the evidence, not the lawyers, are trying to frame it.
In your situation, you said the bottom line is there's simply no evidence that Abner Louima was assaulted in the patrol car before he got himself in the prison. You believe that after 4 weeks
I quoted the medical evidence. I quoted the witnesses who saw him at the scene and at the precinct. And those are the government's truth tellers, apparently. And if they're the truth tellers to some things, they're the truth tellers to everything. So I'm confident that that statement will not come back to haunt me, Reggie.
Joe, are you concerned about...
Yeah, Paul, I mean, you know, we moved for a mistrial based on it, so of course it is a concern, but the judge is confident, and we'll see what happens if they follow the law. I think there's been two trials here. There's been a trial of Justin Volpe and the proof against him, and a trial against my client, so it wasn't really made an issue in this case, sir.
Did the government blow this case by... relying on Volpe too much? Relying on convicting Volpe?
You know, Reg, I guess we'll only know that when the verdict comes in, but, you know,
I mean, an empty chair there. Why didn't you guys say, we want to get rid of that chair? We don't want to think about Volpe. You wanted it there?
I wasn't going to touch that chair for fear that something might get on my hands, but, you know, but the bottom line is, I mean, that chair, that empty chair, I think sends a loud message to people who have observed the trial from the beginning through verdict.
You portrayed your client as somebody who was a peacemaker, who's a professional, who's going to be mature on the job. The government would say that he could have gotten swept up in the moment when he was there defending a colleague and then participating in the violence. Is that possible?
You know, the fact that he's a great guy doesn't prohibit him from doing something that's not great. And I didn't argue that, but I think the character evidence is there for a very limited but important purpose. It lets the jury know who this guy is, and it helps them to decide if that's the type of person who would do these things that he's charged with. Again, without giving my view or opinion of the evidence, because, you know, we're still under the rules, you know, I think the character evidence served a very limited but important purpose.
Do you think that the
To say that there is no evidence of a beating in the police car, you also have to say that you discount what happened to Weaver said about what happened to
him. Right. Exactly what we say. We say the evidence defies what he said. But, you know, and understandably, what I said in my summation is Mr. Luima has exaggerated. Based on his own testimony, he said that. And I don't fault him for it, quite frankly. And I told the jury that, but you can't act on it. So concentrating more on the evidence. No, Cheryl. As a matter of fact, what I told, again, we told the jury it was my client. The jury didn't know it was my client. We let the jury know that. So I'm not concerned about it because I think again his actions in that regard speak for themselves, speak volumes.
Basically, that the liver is not injured enough, and he gets to the hospital, he has soft tissue injuries instead of a fractured skull, so it didn't happen.
Well, again, Reggie, that's like that one statement is hard unless you put it in context. I mean, he was apparently on the ground at the scene, falling on the ground, police officers fell on top of him. I mean, witnesses have said that he looked the same at the precinct as he did in front of the scene when he first arrived at the precinct. So, I mean, it's that type of evidence coupled with the lack of, you know, external injuries that we're relying on.
If the bathroom is,
I gotta go.
Had that happened,
yes, sir. There was an article in the Daily News today that I think said if the bathroom, if Justin Volpe weren't in this case, it'd be a civilian complaint review board case. You know, that was one person's opinion. I don't have an opinion yet because I'm governed by the local rules. So, who knows? Okay, guys.
It would have been a civilian complaint. See, that was my question, by the way.
Excellent question, darling.
And the fact is, let's face it, this would have been a civilian complaint review board case if it wasn't for Justin Volpe. It wouldn't have even made it, much less to trial,
right,
to even be known by anybody outside of a small circle of people who were there that night. And I think that speaks volumes.
That says a lot right there, yeah.
It speaks volumes to the whole situation in the city of New York and in the United States of America. Kaka. So our number, 212-209-2900. Want
to
try a few calls?
Yeah.
All right. Let's take this call.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
This is the unknown angry caller.
Oh, hello.
I think Justin Volpe is a sexually repressed man.
It's not that repressed.
And number two, the ministry of Slobodan Milosevic is growing strong with a new convert named Jimmy Carter. The ministry is growing evil every day, and we must stand up against it.
Do we have to be pro Milosevic to be anti-bombing?
You could be both anti-Milosevic and anti-bombing.
Good.
I don't have
all
a
right
problem.
That's,
I like
us
that. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for calling, angry caller. Hello?
You're on the air.
Hey, Robert, this is Astro Bob. You,
yeah. Paul.
You got the wrong
Paul
name.
And Joni. Robert
wrong
left
show,
it.
I was reading a Connemarch biography under Coburn and Jeffrey St. Clair. And he said, during the first month of the war, NATO planes and cruise missiles made over 10,000 attacks. More than 2,500 cruise missiles were launched, and over 7,000 tons of explosives were dropped. Now, the Yugoslav Foreign Ministry, which has a self-interest in saying this, and according to NATO, they've cleansed a million Albanians. They said that 1,000 civilians, including 43 children, were killed in more than 400-500 sustained serious injuries. They also said about 500,000 workers are jobless due to the destruction of industrial facilities. 2 million citizens have no means for living, cannot ensure the minimum for existence.
Sounds like Justin Volpe is in charge of the operation.
Well,
there,
you know the idea is that what I'm saying is, in counterpunch there of May 1st, 1999, it has a war diary, and the Yugoslavs have released all the targets that NATO hit. And according to this, they also hit. Now, as they say, the Yugoslavs have a self-interest in saying these things. They have to be checked out by the media, and the media can't get in there.
And Abner Luima had a self-interest in saying Giuliani time,
yeah,
too.
Well, yeah,
doesn't make it a lie.
I know, but the media can't get in there to check these things because the bombing is going on. So medieval monasteries and religious shrines, historical monuments and museums, And also public housing.
Well, you know, all us Western Roman Christians, we've been fighting Orthodoxy since the split.
Now we're wiping it out.
800 years ago. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. Sure. Thanks for all that information.
Yes. The Crimean War had a similar beginning. Hello? You're on the radio.
Hi. Question. What is that district attorney's name that was?
Alan Feingrad.
No, there was another one in the beginning of the Louima trial.
Vinegrad is the one I've seen in action. There's a couple others with him, but Vinegrad's the one who's been the lead.
Okay,
attorney.
I thought it was Thompson or something.
Yeah, something like that. Is an assistant,
you don't
but
know. Okay.
Yeah. Well, he's I do know, but
okay.
Vinegrad is the one who's doing all the talking.
Okay, who's the assistant?
I don't, you know, something like that.
Not
important
like
to me.
That.
Not important. Why should it be important?
Because I wanted to know the name. I wanted to find out about this person.
Have you been at the trial?
Yes, I was at the trial.
Oh, right on. What do you think?
I called a couple of weeks ago and told what I
thought. You saw the jury, right?
Excuse me?
You talked about the jury with us.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
My other question is actually with regard to the tape that you played. The nurse who had
pretty much
got the ball.
Magali Loren, yeah.
I'm sorry?
Magali Loren.
Yes, Magali Loren. Do you know of an update on her? Have you spoken to her or anything?
No, I haven't seen her, actually.
Oh.
I know she's around, and, her brother-in-law was brought up, of course, in the trial a number of times.
Oh, he was? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, the whole story of Giuliani time was exposited ad infinitum.
Oh, okay. All right, thanks.
Sure.
All right,
bye.
Thanks for calling.
Bye. You're on the
Hello?
Air.
All praises due to Allah.
Hey there.
First of all, I'd like to know about the nurse. What nationality was the other nurse that attacked her?
I don't know. I don't know the details.
And she didn't express that. Okay. Number two, we do not know was they trying to fire her or were they leaning on her to for her to quit? Or what have you?
They were personally terrorizing her.
She asked for a transfer.
Nothing official, nothing above worse than that. I mean, you could deal with that. If somebody tries to fire you, you just file an NLRB complaint and you win a lot of money if they're doing it unfairly. But if they come into a room and tell you they're going to kill you and your family, then it's sort of hard to defend against that.
Yeah, but not only that, is your word against theirs,
that's
too, right?
Right.
You understand? Okay.
And obviously what she described was the police came right in on the other person's side.
Right.
Yeah.
And she was,
they were ready to arrest her.
According to Magali, she was either married or dating a cop at the same precinct.
Yeah, okay. And my third and final question, when those police officers in the precinct, including the captain, they should have all been indicted because, number one, the captain knows what's going on in that precinct because everybody's telling everything. So when they say, well, I don't know what was happening, everybody that was on duty, this is what my...
I agree with that.
Everybody
knows
that
what
was
happened.
On duty that night should be indicted. And as far as some police officers saying, well, I was there, but I wasn't in the bathroom, that's popcorn. They still should be indicted. And as far as the brother not recognizing... who else was there? Now, dig this here. Monty was part of the system. I remember brothers didn't kill the man, but they were there when the man was killed. And they got time, too.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So as far as these dudes, because they're not people.
I can't imagine that they allowed Justin Volpe to plead guilty in a federal trial without telling who was in the bathroom with him. We have two friends who went up
that,
for 20 years
on
a trumped-up espionage charge. We've talked about it a lot. It's in our Penthouse article. And they got 20 years instead of just a couple of years because they refused to name anybody else.
You dig where I'm coming from?
And they destroyed their lives. They destroyed their family, took everything they owned, and threw them in jail.
Yeah.
You know, 10 times worse than people a lot more culpable because they just absolutely refuse to talk.
You know where I'm coming from? Like Malcolm said, a two-standard system. And we will never get justice here. But for everyone, if you really want justice, and this goes for Europeans also, if you really want justice in America, we all have to get down with the Independent Party and start putting justifiable human beings in office, regardless of their nationality. If they are a human being, we all have to be behind them.
Okay, thank you, Monty.
God recognize. Keep on keeping on, okay. And walk on the right side of the street.
Thank you.
Peace.
The full Monty. And you're on the radio.
Hello.
Yeah, Monty was the perfect lead-in because that's exactly what my attitude is. And your mentioning of the people who were hit with harder sentences because they refused to name names.
Right, and those are just people that we happen to know because we wrote a story about it. But how many people has this happened to, particularly in drug cases?
Happens all the time.
Tens,
yeah,
of thousands. And that's right. Why this is so bankrupt. And that's why I would like to see the media coverage be along the lines of what they're not doing rather than what's happening. Because what we have to raise questions about is the notion that he complied with the textbook definition of conspiracy doesn't negate the fact that the prosecution can insist upon the naming of his co-conspirators.
The judge can.
Yeah,
precisely.
The judge does.
They obviously made a deal with him, right?
They're denying. Everybody denies there's a deal, and then I see a deal right in front of my face. It's like,
well, of course.
Tell me.
Your description of last week was very telling in that regard, because you're saying, of course, it's a deal. Just because somebody says there's no deal, who was it? Charles Hines who said there was no deal?
No, Zachary Carter, the federal.
That's right, and he was saying. I heard him on tape several times saying there was no deal. There was no deal, but nobody's saying. If there's no deal, why isn't he being required to name his co-conspirator?
Or even being asked.
And, of course, exactly. And Monty's point, which is extremely on point, was exactly what I was going to go into, which is that all of the people who were in the station house could hear the screams. Nobody can suggest that a prisoner being walked handcuffed with his arms raised up behind his back so that he's bent over forward with his pants around the ankles constitutes legal treatment of a prisoner being
ever
moved from
that's
a restaurant
right
in any circumstances,
no matter what.
It's unconstitutional.
Maybe in Chile.
All of these people were conspirators in it because they all saw it. And all 60 or 70 people in the station house.
And if they didn't see it, they heard about it that night.
And what's the phrase? Knew or should have known. People
that's
have,
right.
Mike Levine says it all the time. He goes, who knew or who should have known? He says, I've put away hundreds of people for 10 and 20 and 30 years on that phrase alone.
I know.
He said, that, ladies and gentlemen, is a conspiracy, and that's what we're looking at here.
They're not using the conspiracy laws, which I hate anyway.
But not very effectively against themselves.
It's interesting that a lot of people say that you could tell that fascism was coming in Germany in the early 30s when these kind of things happened, when authorities and government authorities were getting minimal sentences while people who were not in or connected were getting huge sentences for the same crimes.
Or well, active in the...
In the opposition. And all of a sudden people start to realize, wait a second, what's going on here?
Just to close, I'd really like to encourage you to, as you pitch articles to people, for instance, at Penthouse and such, to focus on these issues around the actions that are not being taken. Not only what's being taken and an explanation of that and an analysis of that, but also a look at what is not being done.
All right, thank you.
Very important stuff.
Yeah, I agree. We're being diverted from the real questions.
Keep up
here.
The good show.
Thank you. Thanks for calling.
You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, good evening.
Hi.
How you doing?
Yeah, it seems the longer you wait, the more everybody seems to cover what you want to say. what I'd like to add, though, is... for the people around who are in the know, who are aware of the fabric of how law works and how we're being given a shaft job with the way certain cases concerning police brutality are constantly being handled. In other words, there are lawyers, I'm sure, there are politicians, there are a lot of people around who understand that law isn't supposed to work that way, and I'm hearing a resounding... silence. You know, when there's wartime, you always get these professionals, these ex-captains and so forth and so on, who are called in, you know, to give their opinion. you know, as to how things should be and how they perceive things are going to go.
The experts the media use.
Right, and I'm not hearing anybody. I mean, even from, let's say, the African-American community, the high-powered lawyers, who could get on media outlets and explain to us, you know, exactly how the law is supposed to be handled. Like you said, how Volpe was, how he admitted his guilt, but didn't give up his accomplices.
The blue wall of silence.
He admitted he had an accomplice. He said there was somebody else with me who did not intervene, who saw what happened and did not intervene, and the judge allowed him to make a guilty plea
without answering that question.
Unheard of in a federal trial. They're much more like oriented towards dragging out every last bit of information about a case in a federal court trial than they are in a state. Yeah, in the state trial, they get their guilty verdict, it's over. Or not guilty, but in a federal trial, they have this overriding interest in justice, allegedly, where they got to know everything that's going on.
Well, why is it that I'm so curious and confused as to why these things happen? You know, what is the greater picture? Is it the judges being a part of a mindset that makes them feel that these cops really need an easy ride because their job is so hard?
Or is the society really divided into irreconcilable social classes and that the police are basically the armed force of one of those social classes, the rich class?
Right, to which the judge is a part of.
Right, I
don't think that they would feel, I don't think that they would feel that comfortable with convicting someone that might be the only shield between them and the public that they wrongfully convict.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
That's what I have
Good
to
point.
Say. There's more, but a little lot of other people have.
Yeah, we got
a
big.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank
All
you.
All right, thanks for calling. Yeah, we got a big screen here lit up with calls.
You're on the radio.
Hello.
Hello.
You there? Well, they ran to get a sandwich while they were waiting. Oops.
I'll give it the longest possible time. And you're on the air.
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, there you are.
How are you doing? Huh?
Good. Okay. How are you?
Good. I just want to call, all right? It's a black guy at the law enforcement, what happened.
Whoa, we're getting feedback there.
All right.
Got your speakerphone on or something.
All right. It's a black guy for law enforcement, what happened with Abdul Luima there. But, what's bad is, if you've ever listened to a police scanner, you know, like with me, my wife and kids, I don't lock my doors at nighttime and worry about white people coming in and ripping me off. Yeah, it happens, but I'm telling you, I get so tired in the headlines that if you get four white guys beat up a black guy, that's a racial incident. You get four black guys that stab a white guy or kill him or anything else, and that's not a racial incident. It's just a rape, you know, a rape or a robbery or whatever.
Well, you're leaving out one aspect of this. This was also an attack against an immigrant population and immigrant people, and actually it was less a racial incident, even though that's, I think it still is, in the way it's been described, as really an anti-immigrant, and the fact that there was a huge cultural gap and that these white cops in the suburbs really – in the Seven Oaks precinct, which is a Haitian community, do not like these Caribbean people because they don't like the fact that they don't speak English well.
Well, you see, I was in the military for like 10 years. I served time in Cuba with Haitian refugees and everything like that. I've seen a lot down there. I respect everybody. Right now I'm sitting in my truck with two Egyptian males. I'm white. I'm sitting here with two Egyptian security guards that I'm working with tonight. And they're great people. I've broke bread all over the world with people. And it's just, in general, it was a black eye for law enforcement. Yes, it should have never happened. There should have been controls. The fact of the matter is there's a war going on in the streets, and minorities are a big problem. They're the ones committing the crimes. You listen to a police scanner any time. You got black males and Hispanic males robbing, stealing cars, breaking into houses. You don't hear on the scanner.
We don't hear on the scanner about white people stealing corporate millions and
committing
white collar fraud to the tune of trillions of dollars. And
right.
We don't really hear about those white politicians dropping bombs on other countries, etc.
By all means, you're right. I agree with that. But
and we sure as hell don't hear about all the cocaine snorted in those boardrooms either.
You're right, but on a street level, I'm talking like on a street level in that precinct and every other precinct around that city, there's a war going on, and these guys every day, you have to ask yourself when you go to work whether it's going to be worth your life today. However much money you're making, you're going to put your life on the line, responding down to the projects where there's a shootout going on. And do you want to get involved with that or just let them kill each other? But no, you go storming in there, and then before it's all done, you apprehended some people. You got the medics coming in, pulling out the wounded, and then the next thing you know, you got the crowd is against you because all you did was come in and break it up. Nobody got you in there. Like, we didn't shoot, but they're mad. How many times we had to fight our way out of the projects because of that? It's very bad nowadays. It's very bad, and it's not the same as when I grew up. When I grew up, everybody got along. Now nobody gets along. Everybody wants to make an incident or a political statement out of every little thing that happens, and it just gets agitated.
But isn't every little thing a political incident?
Well, it's not. It's not. Some things are just hatred, outright hatred, but it's not based upon race. It's based because the person that's doing it or the people that are doing it are just... They just don't belong in society in general. And yeah, people slip through the cracks. They do. You can't stop somebody. There's ways around everything. They get through. They get into these jobs where they got the power and everything else like that. Just got to know how to control it. And these guys don't know how to control themselves. And it takes something like this incident with Abner Louima that brings it out. That brings out the worst in everybody.
Mm-hmm. Oh, let's see what the rest of the callers have to say.
Well, thank you.
All right,
thanks for calling.
Sure. Thank you.
Hello.
It's good grist for the mill, actually. What do people think about that? What do they have to say?
You know, it bugs me when I hear a guy like him talking about these guys, how hard that job is, and what how many dangers there are involved in. Nobody forces people to take the job. They know exactly what it entails before they take it, okay? Nobody is forcing them to take it. Nobody puts a gun to their head and makes them go and take that job. So, you know, I mean, when they take the job, they know what it's going to entail, and they know what's going to be involved in it, and they have to decide whether they want that particular kind of job or they want to work in a bank or they want to work on Wall Street. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But they're not forced to take the job. So they incidentally, when I turned you on, you were saying something about Louima. Situation would have never come to light had it not been for somebody. I didn't hear that, and I didn't understand what you mean.
For Magali.
Magali Loren, early on, the winner of the Refuse and Resist Courageous Resistor Award. She was a nurse at the hospital who immediately called Internal Affairs and actually was given the runaround, and there was no response, and eventually she called Mike McElary, and then it became a big story.
Right.
Oh, okay.
She was an emergency room nurse.
The real, she's the real hero.
Emergency room nurse.
She's the emergency room nurse. She was the real hero of the Louima situation.
And they were threatening her and everything?
She had to be transferred to another hospital.
No kidding. Is she Haitian also?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And she also was going with a cop?
No, but
she was
later aware. Like many Haitian people, she was attacked by
another nurse who was dating a cop. That's what you're... referring to.
Oh, now I get it. Yeah. Oh, yeah, she was a brave person.
You're telling me.
Yeah, she's that's good. That's fantastic.
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks for calling.
Thank you. And 212-209-2900, you're on the air at WBAI. Let them talk.
Hello?
Yes, actually, I was going to say exactly what the other caller said. I'm a cab driver. I've driven a cab in New York for approximately 4 years, also in San Francisco for about 4 years also. And I'm tired of hearing people who are cops or relatives of cops saying, well, I'm worried about, you know, if he comes home at night. Cab driver is much more dangerous
Certainly
than
have
a police
the same
officer
concerns.
Is.
Right.
And also, I'm going to make some generalizations and some stereotypes, but basically, the rich are getting richer. The rich are not in jail. I mean, the people on Park Avenue or in affluent places in New York City, these are the people who are importing cocaine big time or other kind of illegal activity. And we always hear about, well, you know, this person's coming in with 20 condoms worth of cocaine or whatever. I mean, the justice, there is no justice. And
no, it's interesting you say that, because we have a friend that was on the grand jury, and she said that she did all narcotics cases, and for the most part, they were over $10, $40, really tiny
right.
amounts, yeah.
Exactly,
just
nickel dime.
Terrible.
Nickel
right.
and diming. And I like to end it with saying, you know, I've been listening to WBAI for years. You're like the best on radio, and I'd like to definitely say hello to Monty, and I respect
right.
Monty 1,000,000%, because Monty is a breath of fresh air. Monty is I'm everyday people. That's Monty. You know, he's telling it like it is, and I hope we have more Montys calling up. And my name's Bingo.
All right,
and
Bingo.
One love to everyone out in New York, and I'm going to end it on that note.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for calling, huh?
Welcome to Let Him Talk.
Oh, thanks,
Hi.
Bingo, for that, because nothing makes me more furious than to hear this, the complete subreption of what crime is, this total misrepresentation. It, you know, there would not need to be stealing and
yeah, what do you think about
over
that?
The head and breaking in apartments if there wasn't for crime on Wall Street, and, you know, if there wasn't for the initial crime.
Well, what do you think about ascribing most of crime to minority people?
I think I'm so outraged and sickened by that, because what I'm saying is it would never be that way. I mean, crimes wouldn't have to occur by people that don't have if it wasn't for the initial crimes of the division of wealth. You know, it has to start somewhere, and it begins with the crimes that are not spoken about. Those the crimes, I'm just going to call it Wall Street, but financial crimes are seven times in the dollar value, seven times more money than what's represented on the street as far as street crime. And
how about the savings and loan scandal cost the taxpayer $500 billion?
Yeah, look at this. I mean, this is
$500 billion. So they could do things like build in Las Vegas a 40-story brothel for rich people.
Have you seen what they're doing out there?
And run the bushes for president.
Oh, man.
I have to get to a point about the marijuana thing before I finish, because you want to know something.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, also, just want to mention, too, the thing with Wernick. Officer Wernick.
Yeah.
You know,
I was there for that. You know that? It was very strange, because I was there earlier to get a little bit of sound and to split. You know, that's how I make a living these days. And I do stuff for the American Urban Radio Network as well as Pacifica Radio.
Uh-huh.
And so I went to get my little bit of sound, and there was a little bit more testimony, and I was about to leave, and I said, well, maybe I'll just sit a few more minutes.